Shaza found Gary in the boardroom. He was always there 20 minutes before any of the other directors arrived, arranging his piles of computer printout sheets and other notes around him and going over his facts and figures for one last time before the meeting began. Shaza and Santon had argued before appointing Gary to the board of Courtney Mining. "You can ruin a pony by pushing him too hard too soon." "We aren't talking about a polo pony," Santon had replied tartly, "and it is not a case of pushing. He has got the bit between his teeth, to continue your chosen metaphor, Shaza. And if we try and hold him back, we will either discourage him or drive him out on his own. Now is the time to give him a bit of slack rein." "But you made me wait much longer. You were a late-blooming rose, and the war and all that business held you up. At Gary's age you were still flying hurricanes and chasing around Abyssinia." So Gary had gone on the board, and like everything else in his life, he had taken it very seriously indeed. Now he looked up as his father confronted him down the length of the boardroom. "I heard you've been borrowing money on your own bat," Shaza accused. Gary removed his spectacles, polished them diligently, held them up to the light, and then replaced them on his large Courtney nose, all to gain time in which to compose his reply. "Only one person knows that, the manager of the Adderley Street branch of the Standard Bank. He could lose his job if he blabbed about my personal business." "You forget that both Nana and I are on the board of the Standard Bank. All loans of over £1 million come up before us for approval." "Rand," Gary corrected his father pedantically. "2 million rand. The pound is history." "Thanks," Shaza said grimly. "I'll try to move with the times. Now how about this 2 million rand you've borrowed?"
"A straightforward transaction, Dad. I put up my shares in the Shazaville township as collateral, and the bank lent me 2 million rand. "What are you going to do with it?"
"That's a small fortune." Shaza was one of the few men in the country who would qualify that amount with that particular adjective, and Gary looked mildly relieved. "As a matter of fact, I've used 500,000 to buy up 51% of the issued shareholding of Alpha Centauri Estates, and loaned the company another 500,000 to get it out of trouble."
"Alpha Centauri?" Shaza looked mystified.
"The company owns some of the prime property on the Witwatersrand, and here in the Cape Peninsula. It was worth almost 26 million before the crash at Sharpeville."
"And now it's worth zero," Shaza suggested, and before Gary could protest.
"What have you done with the other million?"
"Gold shares?
Anglos and Vaal Reefs. At the fire sale prices I paid for them, they are returning almost 26%. The dividends will pay the interest on the entire bank loan."
Shaza sat down in his seat at the head of the boardroom table and studied his son carefully. He should have been conditioned by now, but Gary still managed to surprise Shaza. It was an imaginative but neatly logical coup, and if it had not been his own son, Shaza would have been impressed. As it was, he felt duty-bound to find flaws in it.
"What about your Shazaville shares? You were taking an awful chance."
Gary looked puzzled.
"I didn't have to explain it to you, Pater. You taught me. Shazaville is tied up. We can't sell or develop aggressively until land values recover. So I've used my shares to take full advantage of the crash."
"What if land values never recover?" Shaza demanded relentlessly.
"If they don't, it'll mean the country is finished anyway. I will lose my share of nothing, which is nothing. If they do recover, I will be in profit 20 or 30 million.
Shaza picked at that for a while and then changed his angle of attack.
"Why didn't you come to me to borrow the money, instead of going behind my back?"
Gary grinned at him and tried to smooth down the crest of wiry black hair that stuck up on his crown.
"Because you would have given me a list of 500 reasons why not, just as you're doing now. Besides, I wanted to do this one on my own. I wanted to prove to you that I'm not a kid anymore."
Shaza twiddled the gold pen on the pad in front of him, and when he could think of no other criticism, he grumbled,
"Well, you don't want to get too damn clever for your own good. There is a line between good business sense and outright gambling."
"Huh? How do you tell the difference?" Gary asked. For a moment, Shaza thought he was being facetious, and then he realized that, as usual, Gary was deadly serious. He was leaning forward eagerly, waiting for his father to explain, and he really wanted to know. Shaza was saved by the entry of the other senior directors. Santon, on the arm of Dr. Twentyman Jones, and David Abrams, arguing amiably but respectfully with his father. And thankfully, he let the subject drop. Once or twice during the meeting, he glanced down the table at Gary, who was following all the discussion with a rapt expression, the light from the picture window reflecting a miniature image of the crest of Table Mountain in the lenses of his spectacles. When all the business on the agenda had been completed, and Santon had started to rise to lead them through to the executive dining room, Shaza arrested them. "Madame Courtney and gentlemen, one additional piece of business. Mr. Gary Courtney and I have been discussing the general state of the property market. We both feel that property and equities are very much undervalued at the moment, and that the company should take advantage of this fact. But I'd like him to tell you in his own words, and to put forward certain proposals. Would you oblige us, please, Mr. Courtney?" It was Shaza's own way of giving the lad a jolt and cutting him back a little. In the 6 months since his elevation, Gary had never been called upon to address the full board, and now Shaza dropped it on him without warning and sat back with vindictive relish in his wing-backed leather chairman's throne and folded his arms. At the bottom of the table, Gary blushed furiously and glanced longingly at the Stinkwood door, his only escape, before giving the traditional salutation to his fellow directors. "Madame Courtney and gentlemen." He stopped and threw his father a pitiful look of appeal. But when he received a stern, uncompromising frown in return, he took a deep breath and launched into it. He stumbled once or twice, but when first Abe Abrahams and then Santon shot cutting questions at him, he forgot about his stutter and talked for 45 minutes. At the end, they were silent for a while, and then David Abrahams said, "I should like to propose that we appoint Mr. Garrick Courtney to prepare a list of specific proposals to follow up the presentation that he has just made to this meeting, and to report back to us at an extraordinary meeting early next week, at a time convenient to all members of the board." Santon seconded, and it was adopted unanimously. And then David Abrahams ended, "I should like the minutes to record the board's gratitude to Mr. Courtney for his lucid address, and to thank him for bringing these considerations to the board's attention." The glow of achievement and recognition lasted Gary all the way down in the elevator to the basement garage, where his MG stood in his private parking bay beside Shaza's Jaguar. It stayed with him all the way down Adderley Street to the lonely skyscraper of the Sanlam building, which stood on the open ground of the foreshore that had been reclaimed from the sea. Even going up in the lift to the 20th floor of the Sanlam building, he still felt tall and important and decisive. Only when he entered the reception area of Gantry Carmichael and Associates did the vital glow begin to fade, and his stiff Van Heusen collar bit painfully into the corded muscles of his bull neck. The two pretty young girls at the desk showed him the full amount of deference due to one of the partnership's important clients. But by this time Gary was too nervous to take advantage of the chair he was offered, and he wandered around the lobby pretending to admire the tall vases of Proteas, while surreptitiously checking his image in the floor-to-ceiling mirrors behind the floral display. He had paid 40 guineas off the peg for the double-breasted suit in his favourite Prince of Wales check, but the swell of his chest muscles made the lapels flare unevenly, and the material rucked up around his biceps. He yanked at the cuffs in an attempt to smooth the sleeves, and then abandoned that effort and instead concentrated on trying to press his hair flat with the heel of his palm. He started guiltily as he saw in the mirror the door to the partner's sanctum open and Holly Carmichael come striding into the reception lobby. As Gary turned to face her, all his recent bravado and confidence collapsed around him, and he gawked at her. It was impossible, but she was even more poised and chic than the vivid image of her he had carried with him ever since their last meeting. Today she was wearing a blue and white striped Chanel suit, with a pleated skirt that swirled around her calves, allowing just a flash of her perfect rounded knees as she came towards him. Her lightly tanned legs, in sheer nylon, had the patina of polished ivory, and her ankles and her wrists, in the cuffs of the Chanel suit, were elegantly turned, her feet and hands narrow and yet perfectly proportioned to her long willowy limbs. She was smiling, and Gary felt the same sensuous vertigo that he sometimes experienced after bench-pressing 5 times his own body weight of iron. Her teeth were opalescent, and as her mouth formed his name and smiled, he watched it with breathless fascination. She was as tall as he was, but he knew he could lift her with one hand, and he quivered at the almost sacrilegious thought of taking this divine creature in his hands. "Mr. Courtney, I hope we haven't kept you waiting." She took his arm and led him towards her office. He felt like a performing bear on a chain beside her grace and lightness. The light touch of her fingers on his arm burned like a branding iron. Her hair was streaked with a shading of all the colours of blonde, from platinum to dark burnt honey, and it fell in a lustrous cascade to just above the padded shoulders of the Chanel suit. And every time she moved her head, he caught the perfume of those shining tresses, and his stomach muscles contracted. Her fingers were still on his biceps, and she was talking directly into his face, still smiling. Her breath smelled like a flower, and her mouth was so beautiful and soft and red that he felt guilty looking at it, as though he were spying on some secret and intimate part of her body. He tore his eyes from her mouth and raised them to her eyes. His heart jumped against his ribs like a maniac in a padded cell, for one eye was sky blue and the other violet flecked with gold. It gave her face a striking asymmetry, not exactly a squint, but a disconcerting myopic imbalance, and Gary's legs felt as weak as if he had run 10 miles. "I have something for you at last," Holly Carmichael said, and led him into her office. The long room reflected her own extraordinary style, which had attracted Gary to her work long before he had met her. He had first seen an example of it in the Institute of Architects yearbook. Holly Carmichael had won the 1961 award of the Institute for a beach house on the dunes overlooking Plettenberg Bay that she had designed as a holiday home for one of the Witwatersrand insurance magnates. She used wood and stone and material in a blend that was at the same time modern and classical, that married space and shape in a natural harmony that excited the eye and yet gave solace to the soul. Her office was decorated in soft mulberry and ethereal blue, functional and yet both restful and unmistakably feminine. The delicate pastel drawings on all 4 walls were her own work. In the centre of the floor, on a low table, stood a miniature-scale reproduction of the Charzeville estate, as she visualised it after development was complete. Holly led Gary to it and stood back while he circled it slowly, studying it from every angle. She watched the change come over him. All the gawkiness was gone. Even the shape of his body seemed to change. It was imbued with the same kind of massive grace as that of the bull in the arena, tensing for the charge.